Welcome to Day Zero Update for March 3rd, 2024. I'm your host, Chris Elogi.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm Daniel Victoria.
And yeah, we've got a big week this week of a lot of bad news. Mm-hmm. A bunch of layoffs and such that have happened.
Oh, yeah.
Couple of companies that have managed to spin off from their corporate, ownership somehow. A weird lawsuit.
Yeah.
Some new Pokemon news and a couple other things here. We'll get to that stuff. But before we do that, we'll talk a little about we've been playing here for the past week. And I'll let Dan Rib head up the Final Fantasy VII Rebirth discussion here. But I'll talk about what else I've been playing here. Power Wash Simulator. I've been playing the Warhammer 40,000 DLC there, which is very heavy on Warhammer stuff in there. All the jobs are pretty cool machines. It's like two tanks, two different types of tanks, two different mechs, and a big airship kind of thing. You're doing this in a big old facility that's in one of their spaceships that, from the inside looks like a cathedral. You got big stained glass windows that you can kind of keep an eye on. I think they're around Mars is what the description suggests. So you can see some of the stuff that has been done to Mars in the process of you getting this job here. And yeah, as you're talking to people, getting, more information from while you're doing the jobs, you get a lot of little interesting like flavor text and stuff that gives you more of an idea of like what at least the side that you're working on is all about, which is turning people into robots. That is a big thing they talk about, all that kind of stuff, as well as, you get to a lot of text is preceded by, a thing that's saying like, oh, this is, here's facts that you're going to get, or, other stuff, the different kinds of text you're going to get, that kind of stuff. And plenty of stuff that is censored, as I'll censor, things they're going to say. And it's like, oh, this is referencing, this operation that's going on, but it's not going to let them say anything specific. So you get a lot of little weird stuff. And then some of these jobs are covered in a material that it also censors. That's like some sort of residue, what it says, which is pretty interesting. But yeah, all these machines are pretty fun to get around and clean and kind of see some of the cool designs that they have for tanks, mechs, and airship stuff. That is really well done. So yeah, definitely like that. I still have the airship to finish, but I've finished everything else, and yeah, very good stuff. So definitely recommend it if you are playing Power Wash Simulator. It's another worthy DLC to get. Any other one I've been playing, Picross S Plus. I picked that up and bought the DLC for Picross E9, which never came over on the 3DS eShop. So that'll be the first time I'm playing that, but playing the base puzzles that are in the game that you get for $5, which is Picross E, the first game. And so a lot of easier puzzles. It has gives you a good amount of 5x5s, more than the other games do, because they quickly assume that you've got the handle on things. You don't need more than a few of those. And 10x10s are the majority of this game's puzzles. I guess maybe about a third or 15x15, but the later ones kind of focus more on the 15x15s and even up to I think this one has 15x20s and maybe 20x20s, but yeah, looking forward to play some more of that, but that's pretty much all I have to talk about right at the moment. So, Brandon, what have you been doing?
Well, as for me, I am just about finished with Persona 3 Reload. I am done with the pretty much most of it. I now am at the point where I'm fixing to go up against the final boss. There's like a little area I got to go through first before that happens. But I've already started work on my my review, and I'm actually almost finished with it. I got another section I got to finish writing, but after that, it'll pretty much be ready for editing. Hopefully, I'll have it ready to go. If not tonight, then maybe tomorrow afternoon. But yeah, it's really just having played both the original Persona 3 and the PSP version that, you know, sort of turned like a huge chunk of the game into a visual novel. This game, Persona 3 really, Reload really does like improve a lot on the original Persona 3 in just about so many ways. And part of that is because they basically just crib a bunch of shit for Persona 5 and put it over Persona 3. Plot-wise, it's still hit for hit the same game. But visually, the first thing when you boot up this game and you play it, the first thing you're going to think is, wow, this is a lot like Persona 5. And that's because it is. It's visually, like, down to the cell shading and the faceless NPCs, it's just straight up out of Persona 5. The aesthetic is just everywhere. And that makes sense because it works. Obviously, you know, the time period is different because the game still takes place in 2009, so most people are still using flip phones and stuff like that. So technologically, it's still very much in that era, but visually, it is just eating up with Persona 5. There's also the fact that, unlike in the original, you actually control all of your party during combat. This isn't like in the original where, you know, your party was largely autonomous a lot of the time. And, you know, they do a little bits of improvements on the social system, including adding some completely new events that are exclusive to Persona 3 Reload. And some stuff like that as well. But having played this and also having played Persona 5 and especially Persona 5 Royal, this game, it's very easy to see like how much they improved on the foundations that Persona 3 originally laid out. Compared to something like Persona 5 or even Persona 4, there's really not as much variety as those games would go on. Persona 5 in particular had a lot of different, you know, side activities you could take part in that you just don't exist in, that just weren't a thing in Persona 3. And in some ways, you know, because they wanted to make a fairly faithful recreation of the original, that is sometimes a handicap because the original Persona 3 did not have as much content in it as the later games did. That's not to say it's in any way a bad game. It's still a very good Persona game. It's just that you're playing this in the shadow of Persona 4 and Persona 5, both of which were massive improvements over the 4. Persona 4 compared to Persona 3 is almost night and day in how good it is. And Persona 5 was damn near perfection. So, you know, trying to compare that and trying to compare to Persona 3, even with all the bells and whistles they've added on to it, it's very obvious to see where they improved upon the original. But other than that, I'm also playing Splatoon 3 Side Order, mostly getting back into the online play because I genuinely love playing Splatoon online. It's one of the few online games, competitive games, where you don't have to talk to anyone. And the gameplay is really easy, is really like straightforward, so it doesn't require a whole lot of strategy on your part. But at the same time, I'm still absolutely terrible at it. But, you know, it's still Splatoon 3. It's good. And, yeah, that's pretty much what I've been doing. So, yeah, Dan Reb, what about you?
Yeah, so last week I mentioned that I had the goal of completing Persona 3 Reload before the release of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Yeah, that didn't happen. I'm a little bit more than halfway through. I'm in the middle of September. That game pretty much ends in the end of January. So, yeah, pretty much almost there, and it's really cool seeing the plot pretty much lay itself out. You know, I'm not going to give away too much of it, but you know, I think I mentioned in the past where I watched a Watch Mojo ranking video talking about like the most surprising endings in gaming, and I got to the point where I saw what happened at the end of Persona 3, and I was like, oh, okay, well, I know what happens, but I just want to, you know, see how we get there. And it's just pretty interesting seeing how everything turns out. I'm using an FAQ to pretty much get all of the to pretty much get the platinum on my first try. So I'm trying not to miss anything. And yeah, I've already maximized my my charm, my academics, and I forget the other one, but I maximized those, and now I'm just working on personas. And the way it's working out is you only go to Tartarus like when you really have to. So like when you're there, you really have to just maximize the time there. You want to get to the highest floor possible. That way you can just go ahead and move on with the story beats. Mm-hmm. And I remember like when I first started playing the game without an FAQ, and it was like my first Persona game, I didn't know that the Tartarus opens up on specific days. And I was like going through 20 days at a time, and I'm like, all right, I'm wasting a lot of time by going to Tartarus by, you know, nothing's opening up. And that ended up being the reason why I quit. And Persona 5, you know, you were making the comparisons earlier. Persona 5 just did a whole, did a much better job, like, containing everything, mainly because the calendar was better. All of those improvements, like, found its way into Persona 3, so it just makes a whole lot more sense. But I also feel like a lot of the side stories you see are a tad darker. You know, we have, like, the girl... Yeah. We have the girl whose parents are getting divorced. The home shopping network host who's really just a swindler, and he's just giving you all these like, you know, crazy advice to do. You're also hanging out with this.
I said like get rich quick schemes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You also like run into a teenager who's like gonna die soon. You have. Another classmate who's like running track and injures himself, but he wants to really do well for his brother and stuff like that. I'm like, wow, like I didn't realize that, you know, Persona 3 may not be as well loved as 4 and 5, but a lot of like the content that you have to actually earn like really, really hits hard, and that's really what's keeping me in.
So, oh yeah.
I did mention that, you know, I did want to table it for Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and I did. And you know, me and Chris will go ahead and like talk about it a little bit. I'm about 10 hours in, and let me tell you, even though I'm 10 hours in, I don't really feel like I actually did anything. Without giving away too much, the game sort of flashes back to like the beginning of like Cloud and Tifa's relationship and like what he did with Sephiroth to pretty much ruin Nibelheim. And it's just really cool seeing all of that done, and obviously in 4K HDR. Like you go back and play the original Final Fantasy VII, and yeah, that just didn't age well at all. So it's easy to see why, you know, it's really easy to appreciate the remake that this is. And on top of this, you know, if you've played Crisis Core, which I'm hoping you have, it just gives you a little bit of a background, even though that game, the remake of Crisis Core, never actually changed anything. Whereas Final Fantasy Rebirth definitely does, and I'm not going to go too far into what happens here. But one of the reasons why I don't feel like I did anything is because compared to 7 Remake, 7 Rebirth is the full-on open-world RPG that we were hoping we'd get out of Final Fantasy 16. Like, a lot of people were saying 16 was just more of an action game, and it really was, but it did have the RPG elements to really keep you in, especially, like, I felt like it was definitely a nice evolution to Final Fantasy, and this was everything they wanted 13 to be, and 7 Rebirth just feels like a culmination of all those things, and, like, you know, I really have to hand it out to Square. Like, we'll go ahead and, like, you know, dock Square for, like, making games that people really don't want. But, you know, they've made two Final Fantasies in the last year. They've had Octopath Traveler 2, the remake to Star Ocean 2 a few months ago. Like, they've just been hitting out of the park. And Final Fantasy VII Rebirth seems to definitely be on that trajectory. But because it's open world, there are some things that I'm really not feeling... about the way it's made. Like, for example, open world games really require you to have a robust map, and I feel like the map is easily one of the worst things about 7 Rebirth, just because the fast travel system isn't really explained. Like, for example, you can't travel to chocobo stands without a chocobo, because you have to like make sure you have one in each area. I'm in the second region in the game, which is Jonan, whatever it's however it's pronounced, and you have to actually like unlock the chocobos there in either in order to use them. And it's actually really cool doing that. They end up putting you in sort of a stealth mini game where you have to sneak up to the chocobo behind it, but at the same time there's other chocobos looking at you, and if they catch you, then you have to do it again. But luckily, you know, retrying certain things is easy. And there are a whole bunch of things on the map, you know, typical open world checklist where you do these things, you end up getting XP or whatever points you need in order to just go ahead and improve your party. So, you know, there's actually an incentive to do them. And at the same time, a lot of them are actually really fun to do, especially the side quests, because each side quest is actually tied to your relationship to somebody in your party, whether it be Tifa, Aerith, Barret, whoever. And it's really just seeing their attitudes grow from there. And, you know, again, with the open world side quests, you want to look for these towers that'll allow you to open up the world a little more and see more around you. And, you know, just when you thought you, like, check the last box, all of a sudden you have four more go there. It's like, oh, okay, I am going to easily waste a lot of time just go ahead and seeking these things out. So, you know, you definitely want to use the fast travel as much as possible. Aside from that, there hasn't been a whole lot of stuff that's changed. The battle system remains the same way it was before. You can use the D-pad to go ahead and switch between characters however you want. So if you want to use Tifa's melee strikes, or, you know, Barret's gun, or Aerith just healing or using magic from the back, like all of that is open to you. Sort of the drawback there is, of course, you have a 3-person party, so, you know, you already have 5 at this point and you want to be able to use them all, you just can't. But it's pretty cool. I was in this one dungeon in order to get to Junon, where pretty much people get stranded, and it ends up being Cloud, Tifa, and Aerith, and then the other group is Barret and Red 13. And, you know, just the ability to use Barret and all of a sudden, like, shoot things down to solve puzzles that way really opened things up. But that also showed some of my frustration with the map. Like, the map definitely shows, like, where you are in a certain spot, but even though, you know, it tells you where to go, sometimes it'll have things off to the side where it's like, all right, I have to generally go to this area, but I don't know if I have to climb anything or anything of that sort. And yeah, I ended up like walking around for 15 minutes and didn't notice that there were handholds on the walls to just go ahead and climb. So I was like, wow, I, you know, could have just walked around a little more, but I think it should have been a little bit more obvious in that regard. But yeah, like, it's been a while since I've played anything Final Fantasy VII related, obviously the last one being Remake, like, back in 2018. And growing up, when I first played the original VII, I can't really tell you what that game was about. So, you know, just being able to play Remake and then Rebirth right after it, just to see how things change or how things open up, is definitely something I appreciate. I remember my favorite thing from Remake a few years back was the fact that it dives further into the relationship you have with Jesse and other people in Avalanche. And over here, it's definitely doing better as far as the world building. Like, obviously, the last game was primarily in Midgar. And now that everything has opened up considerably, like, I'm just looking forward to running into, you know, the various people in the cast from before. Like, 10 hours in, I just ran into Yuffie. And it's really interesting seeing how she's melded into the cast, because obviously in the original game, she was an unlockable character that you can just go ahead and beat the game and not know existed. And she ends up being the main character in the Integrate DLC that happened, you know, a couple years back. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it so far, but also some of the mundane stuff is definitely tearing me down. Like, definitely the maps are, they just leave a whole lot to be desired. And I do find that when I'm doing side quests, I'm getting killed by enemies a little too easily, and I'm on normal mode, so I just find myself going back to easy, and then after I kill them, I go back to normal to go ahead and just fight the rest of the way. But I'm definitely having a hard time with some of these bosses, especially the ones that fly, because obviously Cloud can't fly, so he has to use abilities to make him jump that high, or maybe just shoot him down with Barret. But if you don't have Barret or Aerith in your party, That makes it really difficult, and I find myself spamming items with money that I don't have. And even though you can get money from the side quests, I'm not getting enough. So yeah, those are some of the pitfalls I'm following through. But yeah, those are pretty much my thoughts so far. About you, Chris?
Yeah, finishing up Remake and Intergrade in the past couple of weeks here, I think was a pretty good tactic for jumping into this, because the Intergrade, when you beat that, it ends with, you know, Yuffie coming upon the destruction of Sector 7 and then going into, oh, here's, you know, Cloud and the gang kind of outside of Midgar trying to figure out what their next move is, and, you know, getting a ride in to what would be Calm, that kind of thing. And they give that driver from that cutscene a whole thing here. He's a guy named Bill, runs a chocobo ranch. So that's cool. His grandson is named Billy. That's a weird thing. And that's kind of when the game starts to open up, as Chadley shows up, drops the weird bit of lore that he was created by Hojo that I did not know at all. And then I found out, just looking it up, that you only find that info out in Remake if you played through it on hard mode. So that's like a thing that I assume most people don't know, if they're not like investigating, you know, all the interactions and such, because there's a lot of dialogue there you can just easily miss. And also he's a cyborg. So that's the whole thing. And I was like, wait, what? You're just fucking casually throwing this shit out, you know, 3 hours into this game? Kind of stuff. And he has a much more expanded role in this game, as he's basically arbiter of your open world progress stuff. As he, instead of just being like, oh, here's you know, challenges to do in your battles, things to do, and we'll unlock materia as you go, he's kind of got to a whole thing where he throws out, you know, intel stuff to do, you know, just explore these different areas and find these things. You know, you find some special enemies to beat that whenever I ran into them, they weren't super hard. Those enemies, they throw up like three goals you need to do. You don't have to do them all in the same fight. So the two I've done, I've gotten two of the three and then just did the third one on another run. So that wasn't too bad for that. But yeah, it's they throw a lot in there. I'm about 7 hours in. Yeah, so
I think, like, out of all the intel things you can do, those are my least favorite, just because of what you mentioned. Like, you know, it's basically just a fight, and then you have these three things to do, whether it be stagger them or like pressure them or, you know, finish within a certain time limit. And it's hard doing all those in one try. And then, yeah, you can do it again and like not worry about the check mark. But at the same time, it's like, this is time I can be doing, I can be spending somewhere else. And like, that's kind of the frustrating thing for me.
Yeah. There's that kind of stuff. There's, you know, your towers, which they have enemies around them. When you first get there, the weird thing is I was exploring the open world before any of that stuff opened up. So I was like, oh, here's a tower. And just, it's like, oh, I guess I can't do anything here yet, because you don't get your special magical gun bone thing that Chadley gives you that activates the towers and does a bunch of other stuff as you figure out. So yeah, there's stuff like that. There's the weird summon thing where you go and find the special areas that can make the so when you go back to Chadley, he has the combat simulator with him, and like in the original remake, you can fights. I think I only ever got two bosses I could fight, two of the summons I could fight to get their materia. Here they have Titan is the first one. And so if you find these little areas, you can essentially add more difficulty options that are easier through that. So I found one of those and then just went on the highest tier to beat them and managed to do it. Not without getting sketchy a couple times, but yeah, it's challenging stuff, though. I had the game crash while I was doing that, so I did all the combat challenges, because there's one for each of the characters. It's like a tutorial, even though when you first control any of those characters, you also get a tutorial pop-up. This game loves to wait until you do a thing for the first time. It's like, hey, here's information you might need to know. Most of which is like, I just played Remake and Integrate. So I'm pretty well aware of how things control or that, which is nice. But they did make some changes for some of the characters that you get to, that you control from the first game, like Eris. Her main combat, you just held down the square button and she just threw out little attacks, and you could hold down triangle to do a harder attack on that. This time you just have to button mash with square and then hold it down if you want to do that more powerful attack, which is more active, but also means that she is much more vulnerable, because, you know, like in Remake, when you're controlling one of the characters, all the enemies tend to focus on you instead of whoever. They do give her a dodge move that is pretty neat for that. So they kind of spread those things out. They flesh out the combat with more combo stuff between characters so that you can pull out the synergy stuff that was part of Yuffie's DLC, that because it's so short, you barely get to use it really. So they make that more of a thing here. There's both kind of regular synergy attacks and special ones you can pull out that give you fancy, you know, cutscenes as you're doing them, like your other, some of your other special attacks. So yeah, they're adding a lot here, and I better understand the system, because coming back to Remake, I did not understand the thing where you're doing proficiency for the weapons. I did not really understand that super well, that you basically just need to consistently use the special move tied to that weapon to unlock it. So I think I did that for Cloud in Remake, for all the weapons, but, you know, Aerith, I didn't do much at all, because she disappears for long stretches of the game. Some of the other characters just didn't click to me, probably because they probably introduced that in the early parts of the game and don't, you know, make it super easy to remember that stuff when you jump back in a couple years later. So that's, now I'm actively focusing on that and getting, you know, a lot of moves. And then you're kind of short on materia as you start, and you probably have a bunch of empty spots. So that's why I do recommend checking out those combat challenges that Chadley has, because you get materia for all of them. So that is worth your time just to add more to the mix, because now they've made it more of a thing. Instead of getting like an auto cure materia that, you know, you want to put on, you know, one of the characters you're not going to control, so that they use cure every once in a while, you have to use the connected materia slots to do that stuff, as well as there's a couple others that do the same kind of thing. So they make that more of an active part of that, and use of your spaces, versus, you know, that being kind of an implied thing that they don't necessarily explain super well. So they kind of flesh out a lot of mechanics in the combat system and equipment and all that, and as well as they throw this whole transmuter thing at you in almost a comical fashion. You're just like getting out of the city, and it's like, here's a transmuter, get out of here. And you're like, wait, why do I need this? That's a thing where you're collecting tons of materials. The nice thing when you're on Chocobo, you collect all the items at once that are in a group, versus having to click, you know, four times to pick them all up. So you get some of that stuff. It does level up as you go, so you're encouraged to at least make one of each of the things that gets introduced, and then they add a few more, so you start actually making, you know, equipment that you can use, which is pretty nice. But I'm guessing you're probably not going to get, like I was, like up to 80, you know, potions and high potions, because you just always use cure on all of your characters. Right now I don't have, like, I have one cure materia, so only one character can use that right now, just as you're going around. So it seems like they're actively trying to make the potions matter in some way, because you can make a bunch of the potions on your own with these materials that you collect a ton of, but you're also making equipment and other stuff as well. So because you're probably not going to have very many shops. The only ones I've seen are just the vending machines that are next to the benches. And they've also made the benches weird, because now that you find those random little chocobo stops and just like, use a cushion. You have to use a cushion to get all your health back on the benches. And it's like, what fundamentally has really changed about these benches, other than these are a little bit disheveled and don't have you know, cushions on them.
Yeah, it's like to go further into it, the cushion pretty much replaces what the tent did in old RPGs, where, you know, if you use a tent at any point in the game, it'll cure your HP and SP, whatever it may be. But for some reason, the various benches you'll see in the game, primarily at the chocobo stops, you can't sit on to rest. You have to use the cushion. But luckily, they're all cheap and stuff. But yeah, it's kind of annoying.
Yeah, and bringing in saves from Remake, Intergrade, and I think the demo. I think I got a pack in there of like 10 of those. Because I was buying them. Because in the vending machines, it's usually like, hey, here's this thing that's cheap for this time. Kind of thing. And that's been the cushions, I think. Because I realized I had like 10 of those already. And I was like, oh, fuck buying these. Because as you said, you don't get that much money piling up so much. Maybe doing side quests and all that will get you some, but maybe I'll just the thing is to make equipment or whatever and sell it, because you're probably gonna have more than you need as you're making more of it. So I don't know, but yeah, the mini games seem pretty cool. I was getting into the card game Queen's Blood.
I'm playing some Queen's Blood right now. That's some pretty addicting stuff.
Mm. Yeah, I was enjoying it in Calm, and then they're like, "Oh, you got to do three to get up to the next rank. You got to beat three," and then I didn't notice where the third one was until the Shinra shows up and ransacks the place. And I'm like, "Oh crap, this is going to be hours until I get back." And it was. Now they're just like, "Ah, oh, they went away. You can go back and do whatever over there." So yeah, they get that kind of stuff in there. Mm. I did find the shack of the dude that sells cards for that, but he's still hasn't been there every time I checked. So that's annoying, but yeah, it's a beautiful game to explore. It doesn't run super great on performance or graphics mode. I believe they're going to do an update to improve the graphics on performance mode, because it's kind of a bit blurry in that mode. But yeah, kind of getting around the world's pretty good, but there's a lot of hitting. You hit circle button to like grab up onto ledges and such and jump around, which looks very silly. Yeah, in the flashback chapter, there's one guy that's in Nibelheim that's just jumping over a fence back and forth, and I was doing that, and it looks even dumber when Cloud's doing it, because it's built for gameplay purposes, not just to see a weird guy jumping over a fence. But yeah, you can just go sitting there jumping off of ledges up to a certain height. They don't let Cloud like jump off of some of the huge drops they have. So I think with a chocobo, you have a better chance of taking those big jumps up and down. So that it makes the chocobo stuff actually pretty good, especially if you just want to get around the map and avoid fights, because you can just run right past those guys most of the time.
Yeah, running around the open world is a little cumbersome, because like you said, like Cloud doesn't have like all the range. It's not like Ghost of Tsushima or Zelda where you can just jump off cliffs and, you know, either die or not. You just can't do it here. So,
yeah, I kind of wish you beat Sid earlier, so you'd be like, just fly around here and drop me off wherever. But that's not a thing yet, at least. So yeah, I'm looking forward to getting around. I'm just kind of doing a lot of the side stuff and looking around the map. I did run into those weird bandits that you ran into a few times in Remake, who you kick their asses, and they mostly, when you beat them, they just stay on the ground. They're like, "Oh, just wait until they leave. We'll run away after that." Kind of thing. That's pretty good bit that they just keep going. So yeah, they got a good sense of humor in this game, where there wasn't a ton of that. So that's been also a pretty good time. So yeah, I'm looking forward to putting some more time into it. Probably on the way to heading back to Calm and fighting some more people. I did like the one lady that builds a wall of boxes around her. Yeah.
Okay.
And you go do that, and she's like, "What the hell are you doing, asshole?"
Mm-hmm.
And then as you beat her, she's like, "Well, I guess the wall is just a metaphor for, you know, something that needs to be torn down, so I'm going to make you the wall." So she's going to aim to beat you and tear you down, I guess. I don't know, but the fun thing is there's a lot of shit to knock around, more than there was in Remake.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically spent a good bit just taking all those boxes and trying to knock them into the little river that's near her, and just watch them float down until they they hit a door that's on the other side of the river. So there's a lot of fun little stuff like that that you can do. But yeah, I'm looking forward to playing some more of that. We'll definitely get some more time into that. But yeah, the open world's pretty fun to get around. Could be a bit better on that stuff. If you had maybe ways of getting up and down more easily, and you know, maybe even just flying around the map a bit, if you could get a glider or something like that, that would be pretty good. Because while it's huge, it's not that huge, really. It seems bigger than you would think, but depends on how many enemies, and those just tend to spawn randomly, as far as I can see. Same with all the materials. All that stuff you generally don't see until it's like 20 feet in front of you, around you, that kind of stuff. Luckily, they don't do a thing like a lot of open world games, just put like that stuff on the map and be like, this spawns here. So you just keep coming back. And it's like, ah, just, it spawns all over the place. Combat hasn't been too tough, though. I did run into one of the side quests from one of the towns, because they had a creature that I think took a cow or something. And you follow the scent the wolf for quite a while.
I died to that multiple times. Like, I gave up. I'll go back when I'm level 40 or something.
Yeah. I didn't have too bad of a time, but it has like one attack that it just keeps doing like 400 damage every second.
It would one shot me every time.
It's like, I need something that counters this, or probably better to just do ranged attacks. But obviously, as you, if you're playing like an Aerith or something, it'll just come after you like every other enemy.
The dodge isn't always fast. The parrying is hard too. So,
yeah, I kind of wish you had better control over your teammates to tell them like, "Hey, run distraction on this guy and keep him away from me." That would probably make it super easy if you could get that to work all the time. But yeah, it's just kind of a weird aspect of the game, of the combat. That's like the one thing that really sticks out to me as being a an issue from Remake, but Remake wasn't hard at all for the way any of that stuff went. So yeah, it's just a weird thing. Kind of a thing I wish they had added to this to have a bit more control, because there's already a ton of stuff you can do with queuing up moves and all that kind of stuff, but they don't even attack much in combat, as far as I can see. Their meters don't fill up very quickly like they did in Remake, which I'm guessing is also to try to force you to move around to get the moves you want coming out of them more easily, which is weird. I think for me, I really like Barret, because he starts off with a special attack. He has overcharge ready to go, and he fills up his bar pretty quickly, which is for like the second half of Final Fantasy VII Remake. I just made Barret my team leader, so anytime he's in the party, we're just wrecking fools left and right. So
yeah.
But yeah, Rebirth's a bit different on that front, especially now you got five people. They have, you know, alternate teams you can set up to swap between, that kind of stuff. And obviously, we're gonna get Yuffie and probably at least one or two other characters, I think, throughout the game. So I almost kind of wish you could move between that more quickly. Maybe there is an option for that, because I think you have to go back to the menus a lot. But yeah, that's Rebirth. Very good game. So I think we'll have more to talk about next week once we start getting past the busy work that the open world has for everybody.
Yeah. And like the last points that I just want to just go over real quick is like, yeah, how fun and deep Queen's Blood is. Again, it's just a card game, but it's also a card game that can also just be one in a real life too. So I wouldn't be surprised if Square Enix, you know, worked with Wizards of the Coast to just make a real one. They probably already have in the special edition, I don't know. But yeah, I'm really having fun with that. And I ranked up, and when I ranked up, all of a sudden, like, Cloud has this vision of, like, the guy who made the card game, and it's going to be its own thing. So I'm looking forward to moving forward with that. And, you know, a lot of what I'm enjoying is also the quirkiness of the dialogue. I'm doing this side quest where we have to wake this guy up, and then it's like, hey Aerith, how do we wake this guy up? And then, like, Cloud's like, yeah, it doesn't matter, just wake his ass up. And then Aerith's like, yeah, we're going to wake his ass up. I'm like, okay, I don't think I ever imagined Aerith saying any of these things, but this is awesome. So it's really, really fun so far.
It definitely feels like they've taken a lot of influence from the Yakuza games in terms of building a lot more quirky, weird stuff into it, which is definitely what they need when you're building out a big open world game like this. So But yeah, we'll talk about that stuff, some more stuff of that Rebirth next week. So let's get to some news.
Mm-hmm.
We got a new month here. Yep. PlayStation Plus has some new games coming out here on Tuesday on the 5th. Mm. We'll go through this for PS5 and PS4. There's EA Sports F1 23. I played a bit of this in EA Play, and that's a good racing game. Mm. Especially if you're into F1, or even if you're not, it's just a bunch of mostly white dudes.
Yep.
Doing a bunch of races. Mm-hmm. If you're into more simulation stuff, this gets into that, as you can do sort of more arcadey kind of short races if you want. Mm-hmm. But you can also get into the longer races where you have to worry about, you know, your fuel stuff and all that, and taking out your tire strategies and all that. So yeah, that's a pretty good game. Mm-hmm. Also for PS5 and PS4 is Sifu.
Yeah.
Which is a fantastic game from 2 years ago. One of the best kind of action games we've had in recent memory, especially on this generation. A game that people should definitely check out. And then, also for PS5 and PS4, Hello Neighbor 2, the newest game in that series, the family-friendly stealth horror series. So people can check that out. I believe it has co-op in it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, people can play that. And the last one here, they're offering Destiny 2 Witch Queen for PS5 and PS4. So people can play some of that stuff in Destiny 2. Yeah. And then they also mention a DLC bundle for The Finals, which is a multiplayer first-person shooter free-to-play game that came out during the Game Awards. So you get a couple outfits and skins for weapons. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Pretty good month there. I already have Sifu, so that's not a huge addition for me, but F123 is pretty good.
Yep. I'll
probably play some of that.
All right.
Last week during the Nintendo Direct Partner Showcase, a game called Ender Magnolia Bloom in the Mist was announced. Seemed to be only Switch, but I guess a few days later they announced that it'll also be coming to PS5, PS4, Xbox Series X and S, and PC as well, especially launching in early access on PC on March 25th. So that'll be out in full on everything else later on this year. But if you're excited to check it out, you can play the early access version here in a few weeks.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the Metroid style game. Mm-hmm. Dark Fantasy 2D side-scrolling action RPG.
Yeah.
Sequel to Ender Lilies, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you'll be able to check that out here in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
For that. And yeah, we knew there was going to be a Greedfall sequel. Mm-hmm. We've been waiting on details for that, and we finally have some.
Mm-hmm.
Greedfall 2, The Dying World, will be launching in early access for PC this summer.
Mm-hmm.
It'll also be coming to PS5 and Xbox Series X and S when it hits 1.0 later on.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not committing to later this year for full release, so PC will be it probably for this year. I assume probably. Yeah. Wait to early next year or something for the full release.
Yeah. They're apparently also kind of shifting the story focus this time around, because this time you're actually playing one of the natives instead of one of the colonizers. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, native of Tyr Frady.
Mm-hmm.
Uprooted by force from your island and taken to the continent of Gakane.
Mm-hmm.
Where the colonists are from.
Yep.
So that's a fun whole thing to go into.
Oh, yeah. That game had some of the weirdest art direction I've ever seen for a game like this. Because the whole concept is, yeah, it's supposed to be like the Age of Sail, and you're like a person going to a colony in a place that's ostensibly supposed to be North America by way of, I guess, Celtic Ireland. But the way like all the factions are designed, so like there's the Bridge Alliance, which is like essentially supposed to be like the Age of Enlightenment type people who are like all scientific and everything, and they're like vaguely kind of Middle Eastern but not really. And then you have like the Nation of Thelame, which is like supposed to be the religious part of that era. And like their priests are dressed like conquistadors. Their regular citizens and like regular clergy are like Methodist type clergy, like Protestant, High Anglican. And their inquisitors look like pilgrims. It's really bizarre. But it was a fairly solid, you know, RPG. It was janky as all hell, but that's to be expected from Spider. Yeah. So
we'll see if this one's a bit more polished when it's out.
Well, they're doing early access, so maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that. And then, yeah, we had the Pokemon Direct where they... kind of just announced a bunch of updates for all the existing games and apps for that. But they did have one new thing to announce. Technically, there were two. There was a mobile game that's focused on the card game.
Mm-hmm.
Or their big thing was like, you get two packs to open every week or day or whatever it is for free. And it's like, okay, I guess that's the whole thing you can do. But yeah, they also announced Pokemon Legends Zeta A. That won't be out until 2025, which I guess fuels the speculation around Switch 2, that it may be like an early title for that, if they're waiting until 2025 to get this one out.
Yeah.
And yeah, this sets up in the world of Pokemon X and Y, which I believe was sort of centered around a big like Paris-like city.
Mm-hmm.
Is this one. Seems like it'll focus just on the city. You'll be doing adventuring in and around the city and dealing with the Pokemon, they're just all over the place. Mm. But yeah, it's a Pokemon Legends game, so I'm curious sort of how that will go. But yeah, not really too much in the way of details here. Mm. Just kind of a teaser trailer, so I imagine they'll have more details maybe later this year. But yeah.
Yeah, the official Pokemon tweet for the trailer said that the game will take place entirely in Lumio City. Which is kind of weird having a Pokemon game take place in one city because there are normally so many in whatever region. But yeah, like this is a very popular region amongst like fans of the series. So I'm looking forward to this. And I really enjoyed the last Pokemon Legends game. But the main thing about this one is that they didn't show anything. If anything, they showed the Switch logo. So yeah, this is probably going to come to the current iteration of the Switch, which is, you know, you want to be hopeful considering both of the last few games were really, really janky. But again, like I really enjoyed Pokemon Legends and I might have even enjoyed it a little bit more than Scarlet and Violet. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. But what they showed was basically nothing. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll wait to see more details on this one. If it'll be like the last Legends game, Arceus, or if it'll be something different.
Maybe. Maybe. We'll see.
Yeah. But yeah, speaking of Nintendo.
Yeah.
We also found out that they have filed a civil lawsuit against the developers behind the Yuzu emulator, which is an emulator that basically emulates the Switch.
Mm.
And has been generally used to emulate games, Switch games, you know, that just came out or before they're out. Mm. Most famously, Tears of the Kingdom was a big one here, as they played it over a million times. That game was downloaded a full week and a half before it even came out. I believe the Metroid game as well had some similar. So they filed this in the U.S. District Court of Rhode Island. Suit claims that Tropic Haze, who are the makers of Yuzu, unlawfully circumvents the measures the company has in place by executing code necessary to bypass many of the technologies associated with the Switch console and its games. As they put it, Yuzu decrypts Nintendo Switch game files using an illegally obtained copy of production keys that are secured on the console itself. These keys are then passed around on illegal sites, giving anyone and everyone the means to download and play the company's games on systems outside of the handheld console hybrid without spending a single cent. So they're claiming damages from that. In effect, Yuzu turns general computing devices into tools for massive intellectual property infringement of Nintendo and others' copyrighted works. Today, Yuzu provides an internet user, any internet user in the world, with the means to unlawfully decrypt and play virtually any Nintendo Switch game, including Nintendo's current generation of most popular games without ever paying a dime for a Nintendo console or for that game. To be clear, there's no lawful way to use Yuzu to play Nintendo Switch games, including because it must decrypt the game's encryption. Defendant must be held accountable for willfully providing users the means to violate Nintendo's intellectual property rights. At such a scale, the harm to Nintendo is manifest and irreparable. And yeah, they're definitely going through civil court because they probably figure any sort of criminal complaints would probably not work. And yeah, but Yuzu is definitely like one of those emulators that has been pretty much doing the Icarus thing for a while, as they're keeping up with the new releases, kind of. The team is taking a Patreon and sort of emulating a current gen console is definitely like one of those things. It's like, it's definitely in a gray area for emulation stuff. If this was like a Wii U emulator, which I don't think Nintendo has really touched any of that stuff too much, or, you know, DS, 3DS, Wii emulators, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, supposedly they make about $30,000 a month from its Patreon. And let's see, Nintendo's asking for $150,000 in damages, as well as any additional damages and profits usually made from its violations, and demand the developers stand trial. So probably trying to come to some sort of settlement, I assume. Whatever it is, but yeah, it's an interesting case here. But yeah, people are definitely freaking out in a way. It's like, I don't know if this is going to affect any sort of current laws that allow emulators to be used generally without much restrictions. But yeah, I believe that it is not an easy process to back up your own games on the Switch and or to the PC to emulate legally. I believe that's a pretty complicated process. So the people that generally hide behind that stuff are probably most likely not doing any of that. But that's, I think people do on their, you know, that's up to them to decide what they find comfortable doing or whatever. But yeah, interesting case here.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot here. And, you know, Nintendo is always going to be like the biggest like police for this sort of stuff, especially like, you know, with how protective they are with their IP for generally all reasons, including ones that are stupid, like shutting down tournaments. This one, I'm like, I'm not saying I'm completely on their side here, considering, like, you know, emulation itself isn't illegal. It's the whole, like, you know, sharing ROMs and stuff that you may not have. And there's, you know, there really isn't a whole lot of proof to, like, really substantiate people's claims when they say that they have them. But the main thing here, especially with this story, is the fact that, you know, they go off and say that Tears of the Kingdom was pirated over a million times. And then in that time frame, the people that hacked the game had their Patreon increased by X number. Like, yeah, the writing's on the wall there. Nintendo is going to go after them and you know, whoever's next. And they're basically just saying, all right, we got Yuzu. Whoever is next is probably going to go down too. So don't do it. Like, they're pretty much daring everyone to do it. And, you know, someone probably will, but I just don't think we're going to find anything as capable as Yuzu in the near future. You know, there's definitely going to be something soon, and piracy is going to continue. But yeah, like, Nintendo has a lot of stuff here, and I don't really think Yuzu has much to combat it. And what hurts them here is, like, you know, the damages, and if there actually were profits, which I'm assuming there were, because, you know, while people are going to emulate for the right reasons, there are people that absolutely won't. So yeah, a tough pill to swallow there for people in that community. But at the end of the day, I do get it.
Yeah. Yeah, ultimately, I don't think this really affects the greater emulation stuff, but it definitely throws a wrench in people's plans, especially if they are trying to emulate consoles that are, you know, actively out there. But yeah, let's get to some more news, some more positive news here before we get to the bad news. Remedy Entertainment has entered a deal with 505 Games to purchase the entirety of the Control franchise, the original Control game, Control 2, whatever they're going to call it, the multiplayer spinoff project, Project Condor, and all future Control projects that they are ever planning on working on for about $18.4 million. Yeah, that's fairly cheap for that, but the only real caveat, I believe, right now is that 505 will keep the publishing rights for the rest of this year as they go through the transition period to transfer all that stuff over to Remedy. But yeah, all publishing agreements between 505 and Remedy will be canceled immediately by this mutual agreement. Publishing, distribution, marketing, and other rights licensed to 505 games are reverted to Remedy with immediate effect as well. But yeah, there'll be that slight delay on the publisher of the original Control game will be transferred over by the end of this year. So yeah. Yeah, after this transition period, 505 games will have no future royalty or other rights to Control. So yeah, that's great news for Remedy. They'll have sort of full control over this Alan Wake Remedy Control, you know, universe that they have here. And that'll be good news for them.
Yeah, it definitely is like kind of weird in the sense where you would think that they owned it already anyway, but I guess they didn't. And either way, it doesn't seem like, you know, 505 is like being jerks about it. It's like, yeah, this is your property. Go ahead and take it. You made a bunch of money. Use your money.
Yeah, I believe 505 kind of was the funder for Control and kind of with that got a lot of rights of first refusal and all that to it. So that has kind of led to them to this point of just fully purchasing it out from them. So that's cool. Cool to see.
All right.
And then, yeah, next up here, part of the Embracer fallout, Saber Interactive is being sold to a group of private investors in a deal worth $500 million to essentially free the company out from control of Embracer Group, which is great news for them. And, yeah, they'll be free from all the bullshit that Embracer has sort of spread on to their projects, though they still seem to have control of that Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic remake. But they got a bunch of other stuff going on. I believe that Jurassic Park survival game is them, as well as a bunch of other stuff. So that's good that they were able to kind of buy themselves back out. Shame that they sold out in the first place, but, you know, that stuff happens, so good on them. There is a rumor currently circulating that Gearbox is working on a similar kind of deal. But that hasn't been finalized yet, so we'll see if that happens here in the next couple of weeks. But that wouldn't be a surprise either. So yeah, there's that. And the other one, it's a bit of a surprise. Toys for Bob is splitting from Activision, going indie. In a sense, though, they are... Go ahead.
I was going to say, good idea.
Yeah.
Get away from Activision because they will destroy you.
Yeah, though it seems like in their blog post they put up on the 29th, they are potentially exploring a possible partnership with Microsoft.
Yeah.
So seemingly wanting to maybe still work with Microsoft, especially if they're working on... You know, maybe Crash Bandicoot or Spyro.
Yeah, or Star whatever. Control. I would like them to go back and do some more Star Control content. That game did not get the attention it deserved.
Yeah. Seems like a means for them kind of having a bit more control of their destiny of sorts. But yeah, they are seemingly working on something new, but it's in the very early days, so it's probably going to be at least a few years before you see anything from that, but cool that they were allowed to do this, especially as there's some scuttlebutt suggesting they were potentially closing. But I believe that was more the office was closed.
Yeah.
And they're moving to like a remote studio setup. So that probably works best for them.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll have to see what's in their future here.
Yeah, this is definitely fantastic news. I mean, I'm somebody who has gone on a record and said that, oh, you know what, since Microsoft is the good guy company, you know, going ahead and buying Activision is great for a company like Toys for Bob, because it means that we can get more Spyro and Crash. Obviously, mm-hmm. that didn't happen. You know, the news came out last week that, you know, they were shuttering their office down. Of course, all of us assumed that that also meant they were shutting down their studio. And I'm glad that that wasn't the full truth. You know, I'm sure mm-hmm. that they're losing some people. But at the same time, like, it seems like their development team is going to be fully intact. So I'm happy about that. And, like, yeah, working with Microsoft, like, is definitely going to have people, like, scratch their heads. But publishing is hard, you know? A studio can't publish by itself. And when they do, then normally they have a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and you don't want that. So, you know, I don't know what Toys for Bob is working on. But, you know, hopefully if it's Microsoft, then they can go ahead and get some of those IP in order. Because, yeah, they don't have direct license to use them. Like, it would be a nice idea to go ahead, because it's really hard to make, you know, a platformer like a Crash or a Spyro without those names behind them. So
yeah,
we'll see how that goes. But yeah, we need all the good news we can get. So
yeah. And I do mean it with the Star Control stuff. Like, that game was a big deal back in the retro era, but it's got enough, like, its universe is big enough that they could easily make a game that is on par with some of the best sci-fi games that are out there now. Seriously. And it doesn't even have to be that complicated, you know, gameplay wise. The original sure wasn't.
Yeah. But yeah, there you go. Some good news.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get to the bad news of the week, the layoff dump truck.
Yeah.
As there was a bunch of that this week. And first up here was from Degout Fabrique that mm-hmm. announced that they have halted production due to difficulty in finding funding and publishing help for the next game. This is one of the things that hasn't been talked about much, but the general VC sort of funding system for, you know, indies and smaller devs and all that to get some funding for their next game has really dried up here in the last year or so. And yeah, Degout Fabrique has made a lot of cool games. It made like Johann Sebastian Joust and Sports Friends and Mutazione and Salt Sea Chronicles from last year. But none of these are like huge selling games that would, you know, set them up to make their next game for, you know, the foreseeable future. But so they're very much one of those kind of developers kind of looking for help for the next thing. And seems like they probably ran through every option they could find and kind of ran out of options and had to decide that, you know, their only good option here is that they effectively have to shut down and are laying off all the everybody, but I assume the people that were running it so they can essentially manage the rights for the games that they do have for sales purposes and all that, but leaving hope that maybe someday things will get better and they could maybe reform, but that's probably not likely to happen. They have definitely put out, you know, messages hoping to get their people that are being laid off some help getting new jobs, but obviously they're within, you know, thousands of other people that are in the same boat. But yeah, these people are in Denmark, at least a lot of them are. So, but yeah, a lot of things you'll see here in a lot of these announcements is that people in Europe are being laid off. They'll have a better time because there's better social safety nets to help them, you know, land on their feet a little bit better. And say here where you're just kicked out the door and told to fuck off. Good luck getting anything else.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll get unemployment, but maybe not. Who knows? But our next up here, Supermassive Games.
Yeah, has laid off. Yeah, I was fixing this. I got the wrong one. Go ahead.
Yeah, Supermassive Games has laid off roughly 90 employees. Yeah, they had 150. Let's see, the from Bloomberg. The publication reports that 150 staff members at the British studio were informed today that they are at risk of being laid off in accordance with UK labor laws. That requires companies, so they have to work through all the options for potentially moving them to other positions or whatever, or helping them find other jobs elsewhere. that kind of stuff. Because again, Europe is much better at helping give employees the rights when they're getting laid off.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to go through all this stuff here. They're laying off, let's see if it's 150 and they're laying off 90. Or no, they're made up of 300 employees.
Mm.
I guess they're letting 150 know that 90 of them will be laid off. So this has roughly about 30% reduction in staff, which makes some sense for them because they probably, worked on a bunch of stuff here recently.
Mm.
Of the quarry, Little Nightmares 3, probably working on some more of the horror stuff they've got up in the near future. Little Nightmares 3 is due out later this year, so it's probably one of those where they've ballooned up to work on a number of projects at once, and kind of when those get released, you end up having more people than you have work for them and money to pay them, I guess. And that unfortunately leads to this kind of awful news here. So, yeah, I wish those people the best of luck.
Yeah, definitely.
Then next up here, one of the biggest of the week, PlayStation announced they are laying off 900 people across various studios. London studio will be shut down entirely, which I think was a fairly small studio. They're working on VR and other side project stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, people from across Insomniac, Naughty Dog, Guerrilla Games, Fire Sprite, as well as, a bunch of their technology, creative, and support teams are also being affected.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be about 8% reduction of staff, about 900 people, about the same percentage that Microsoft's layoffs were, although they have about twice as many people as PlayStation has for that. And also mentioned that some games have been canceled. We know that Naughty Dog's Last of Us Online was canceled, I believe, and some of the leak stuff, the Twisted Metal game that's been rumored for a while got canceled, that Fire Sprite was working on. I want to say Sucker Punch got through this without any layoffs or any significant amounts, because I assume they're in the middle of working on Ghost of Tsushima too.
Yeah.
And that probably insulates them a bit versus some of these studios that just released games like Guerrilla Games with Horizon Forbidden West and the VR game last year, and Insomniac obviously just released Spider-Man 2. Naughty Dog had the game canceled.
Mm-hmm.
The Last of Us game canceled. And they're in the early stages of some of their other stuff. Fire Sprite, I think, was where the Twisted Metal game was being worked on. So that's some extra people there. So that seems like what their plan is all about, is slimming things down when the projects are kind of not there to require these people, and maybe build back up when those projects are in full need of people. But for now, they're kind of clearing out a bunch of stuff, jobs, unfortunately, leading to a lot of heartache. And as we said, the U.S. people basically got notified that day that they're need to get their stuff and go home.
Mm-hmm.
People in the UK will be going through that process of seeing if there's other work for them or getting recommendations and such for other places, that kind of stuff. And Japan has not been laid off, and I don't think any people over there have been laid off just yet, because Japan has even more strict laws on that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to go through a bunch of processes to
Get
to that point. So again, as we said, studios and developers in the U.S. get their stuff cut off as soon as possible, and everybody else gets a softer leaning on that stuff. So some bad news there for PlayStation as they try to figure out their plan here for the rest of this generation into the next generation.
Yeah.
As they've had a pretty good first half of this generation, but they're kind of in that middling period where studios have been putting out stuff, but then it's like, what's their next thing? And they're, you know, putting a lot of money into a lot of these games.
Mm-hmm.
So much so you're dealing with the increased stress and I think from some of the financial year stuff.
Yeah.
The big thing was that their profit margin at PlayStation is the worst of all the Sony branches.
Mm-hmm.
Has been. So that's seems to be a large reason for this. Even though they're still making plenty of money and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just, as part of the business, the meta for the business is, you know, high profit margins, low risk and slimming down because less payroll is more money for execs and shareholders.
Yep. Oh yeah.
And so that's the fun part of all this.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's PlayStation. Next up here, we got Deck Nine.
Mm-hmm.
Makers of Life is Strange, True Colors, and what else have they done? They've been doing a bunch of that stuff. They've done the last few Life is Strange games and some other stuff, and they have announced that they are going to be laying off 20% of their staff.
Mm-hmm.
They put a statement like that. 20% of Deck Nine staff is roughly 30 employees. So yeah, that'll be a good amount of people there, unfortunately. But yeah, they seem like they're also in between big gigs, so probably trying to work on whatever's going to be their next big thing. And yeah, this is more bad news. And then yeah, we got another gut punch here with EA announcing that they've laid off 670 people.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, Andrew Wilson put out a company-wide letter informing staff of the publisher's restructuring. They're also making some company restructuring and refocusing what they're working on, meaning that they are going to focus more on live service titles and basically try to get off of working on external licensed titles. I know that doesn't include sports games. That means more the Marvels and Star Wars stuff. Because apparently another big thing is that the fees that Marvel and Disney and LucasArts requires for working on their licensed games isn't like $100 million or something like that. Some incredible amount that's, you know, as I said, profit margin, that's a huge thing that cuts into that.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like EA is particularly reacting negatively to that stuff. I believe they are rumored to have canceled a Star Wars game, potentially Respawn's first person shooter Star Wars game. Mm. That might have been related to The Mandalorian. Who knows? But I believe they're still working on the Black Panther game. And maybe the third of the Jedi games from Respawn. But probably after some of that stuff is finished, they will focus more on original IPs and EA properties and kind of continue to focus on, you know, their sports games and Need for Speed and that kind of stuff that they fully own and, you know, don't have to pay third parties as much for that stuff. So, yeah. That's unfortunate. And yeah, that's going to be more rough times. It's almost at the point where you're kind of looking at, okay, who hasn't laid off people in massive numbers? And it seems like Take-Two and Ubisoft. Who else?
Basically, the entire AAA part of the industry is just laying off just scores of people.
Yeah. Seems like retaining people between projects is going to become much less of a thing, even than it was already not much of a thing for a lot of companies. Because a lot of companies work with contractors. It's like a way to bulk up during projects and that stuff where they just, you know, let those contracts expire and move on until they need more people, that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's been rough. It's seems like it's getting up to like 7,000-8,000 people now have already been laid off here by the end of February. And that's just rough. Mm. And we still got 10 more months to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to be transparent about things, I was one of those 670 people at EA affected by these layoffs. And yeah, it sucks. So like I'm not going to go into like any personal detail or, you know, business-wide details as of yet. But like, you know, personally, you know, as someone that like went to the Game Awards last year and met a whole bunch of people that, you know, I looked up to, and like seeing how many people there who weren't in gaming but wanted to be in gaming and like were asking me things about, oh, how do I make my way into the industry and stuff like that. You know, like I'm somebody that got my degree in journalism. I intended on writing for a site like, you know, GameSpot, IGN, and Kotaku. And, it didn't fall that way. But I found myself in the industry somehow. And a big part of it is like, you know, doing shows like this and writing for Smashpad and things like that. And like, you know, we've done this show long enough to see that layoffs and studio closures have happened before. In previous years, we probably see like maybe three, maybe four a year. And then when those happen, they pretty much get picked up by another studio. You know, and it was super quick. Now that's not the case anymore. You know, we've gone about it before. We're unfortunately in unprecedented times yet again. You know, we're nearing 20,000 going back to the past 15 months. And that sucks. Like, there are a lot of people who have been displaced for more than a year and they're still looking. Like, I don't know, like, what the solution is. Like, for me, you know, I got a pretty nice severance package, but I also know a whole lot of people who didn't. And like, yeah, I don't know if this will last me like when it's supposed to last me. But I'm also someone who says that and somewhat jokes around that, oh wait, okay, if I have to drive for Uber for a little bit, I'll do that. But you know, I don't want to. I want to continue working in the gaming industry because I busted my ass to get here, and I don't want to like lose that. But at the same time, it's like, you know, a bunch of people, especially engineers, can be paid more at a place like Google. But at the same time, like, it's a mundane job. But at the end of the day, like, that's the that's where we're at right now. I know when I got the news several weeks ago, I had an interview within the company. I had an interview somewhere else, and I thought they went well, but unfortunately, they went in another direction, and like I'm back at square one again. And I know there are plenty of people who haven't even had an interview. So it's like, as much as I think this sucks, there are people who've been at it worse. And you know, I've been at this for almost a month now, and you know, all of a sudden getting news that PlayStation laid off 900, for me, like, obviously I feel sorry for all those people. You know, I feel sorry for all their families, but at the same time, these 900 people are also going to include people who I'm going to find competition, and that sucks. Like, for example, Guerrilla lost their community manager. She is an award-winning one. Out of PlayStation, three of their recruiters are people that I know very well on LinkedIn, and they are extremely active in the community helping people out, and now all of a sudden, they found themselves displaced. And yeah, like, what exactly do you tell these people? I wouldn't be able to know, and I'm somebody who's lucky enough to have like a lot of support from, you know, various friends, family, loved ones, and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it's like, still sucks. Even though you might have been through it in your own industry, still sucks. Like, they know how much it sucks, and yeah, it's like we just feel trapped. And until, like, you know, the jobs come again, and we don't even know if they will. It's just, yeah, we're just stuck here, and we just hope things improve. And I don't know if there's going to be any indication of that happening soon. As Brandon mentioned, it's pretty much happened everywhere in AAA. Some people are saying, oh, it hasn't happened at Nintendo yet. But at the same time, Nintendo closed their marketing office a year ago in Redwood City and pretty much forced them to move all to Seattle. And yeah, like, that may not be a layoff, but they still lost a lot of staff there. And there are still people who have been displaced because of that issue. So they're not really innocent in this either. A lot of people will go ahead and share that story about what Iwata and Miyamoto and a bunch of other Nintendo execs did to keep their guys or people. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes, but you know, the reality is things in Japan are much different. Like, you know, I don't mean to go political with our things, but the tax dollars in Japan actually take care of that city. The tax dollars in America do not help us at all. So
yeah,
it's just tough. And yeah, I don't know what to do, and I'm just crossing my fingers, and I'm just going to, you know, continue to grind until something good happens. I just don't know when that'll be.
It's also cultural too. Japanese work culture, as hardcore and honestly self-destructive as it is, typically a lot of those companies in Japan don't really like to fire people. They just sort of passive aggressively suggest that you quit. Oh, so yeah.
And then the other thing is that when people get displaced in Japan, they do have companies that are like literally there to make sure you have another opportunity. You know, it doesn't always happen immediately, but the fact that, you know, they work, they try their best to make sure that their workforce maintains their workforce. It's a big deal. So yeah, in America, that's not the thing either. I mean, like there are some companies that have said that, oh yeah, we're making sure that we're going to do our best to move people into different positions within the company. It's not always that easy. Sometimes that means they're just giving you the internal job applications and you apply from there. But at the end of the day, you're still competing with internals and externals, and you know, you can't just be moved. It's never that easy. Like a lot of people have told me in the past, like, you've been working on that game for the past 8 years. Don't you want to move? And I'm like, yeah, I've always wanted to move, but it's not my choice. So yeah,
it's gonna be a rough time here for the rest of this year, seeing more and more as the rest of the big publishers announce their layoffs. That seem inevitable at this point. But yeah, hopefully we get some more good news here at some point. There will be some new studios that get formed, but probably not enough to account for even a small chunk of the ones getting laid off. Like I saw some of the former Call of Duty people formed a studio that got picked up by somebody. I forget who. As they're making a new first-person shooter thing for that. So, yeah, there's going to be some stories like that, but not nearly enough. As I said before, Degut Fabrik, there's not that much VC funding out there to cover a lot of that stuff. And, yeah, it's just going to result in a lot of people having to find other jobs.
Yeah.
Either for temporary or ones that end up becoming more permanent than they hoped. And like you were mentioning Google, and they had a whole thing that happened recently where people unionized within their company, and as they were going to hearing about getting them to actually sit down and you know, do a deal, they found out they all got laid off. So yeah, all these fucking companies are willing to do that kind of shit. Depending on how that goes, but yeah. Hopefully we get to a point where we get, you know, industry-wide unionization. That would help a lot with this stuff. If you go and read how things go in like the movie and TV industry, how that stuff works, people can get, you know, their health care covered while they're laid off, and even get some pension type stuff to help them make ends meet a bit more easily. That kind of stuff that definitely a lot of people in the gaming industry would love to have that kind of stuff if they could get, you know, these companies to the bargaining table and that stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, like, I am also definitely all for unionization, but for a lot of these cases, that doesn't really, like, while it'll help, it doesn't really solve the problem either. Because like if the company decides they're going to close your studio, they pretty much have due cause, because your studio probably isn't making enough money. And that's reason enough to go ahead and let you go, even if you do have a union behind you. But like, yeah, like it's just funny seeing how the churn works. I actually had a call a few days ago regarding a PR opening with Activision, and it was like a 6-month contract, and I'm like, you do know that I know that you guys laid off all your PR guys 2 weeks ago, right? So you basically want to like have me take this job. And at the end of the day, like, you know, if it's offered, I'll take it, because we have nothing else to do. It's just weird.
Yeah, there's a lot of people laying off long-time employees that are getting paid pretty well to bring in new people that are getting paid less. That's a very common tactic in this stuff.
I hate to continue to use Activision again, but like Activision is, you know, they've been really great with their live service titles, you know, whether it be Call of Duty or whether it be their Blizzard portfolio. But all of their titles have at least 1 to 2 community managers, and each one of them pretty much let them go. And in the meantime, like, Microsoft has said the reason why they've been let go is because they were made redundant, but none of Microsoft's community managers have been there for more than 2 years. And a lot of these roles were for 6-month community manager roles. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure your live ops game is going to last more than 6 months. You can't really do it this way. But yeah, it's like the hiring practices just need to improve for various positions. And it doesn't seem like they have it right basically anywhere. I was talking a while ago about, like, you know, myself as well as others competing I was talking to like one of my coworkers before who specializes in 3D art, and like, yeah, he's a well-paid veteran who's been in the industry for like 10 years, but you know, all of a sudden you have like Naughty Dog and Insomniac lay people off, and it's like, okay, cool. I have 10 years in mobile, but it's not even close to 3 years for working for Naughty Dog. And it's like, you know, it's like somebody who just got out of college doing stick figures, competing with somebody who made The Lion King. It's like, you know, there's no competition there. They're going against Greek gods. It's just tough.
Yeah. Yeah. It's gonna be a fun time. And yeah, Microsoft, especially, it seems like of late they love contractors, which seems that has been a part of the problem with like Halo Infinite, is that a lot of those people are 18-month contractors. Mm-hmm. And so you probably spend a good chunk of your first few months just trying to figure out the way all their tech works. And then as you start to get into a groove, you're going to be laid off pretty soon. And then, you know, people take that knowledge that they learn with them, and then you lose a lot of that, you know, foundational knowledge stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like Microsoft is all in on that kind of stuff. Because if the way the law works, if you're on contract for over 18 months, then they have to offer you a full-time position.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the churn comes in. They bring in people for 18 months. I think the recent Forza Motorsports, they had one person working on like a lot of the art for alongside the tracks stuff. And because of that stuff, one person that was talking about this stuff essentially became the only person working on it, because the people that were, you know, onboarding them got laid off as they had reached their time limit there. And so it's like this massive game basically only have one person building, you know, the trees and the side stuff on these courses for all the courses that are in that game. And you're like, geez, that's some real bullshit. And so, yeah, it's like all the bullshit the rest of us have to deal with all the time. So, yeah, there's a lot of that shit there, too. And yeah, so we'll end it there. Enough of this bad news for 1 week. We'll see if we can get through another week without some, but I doubt it. We'll see. we're going to maybe try and eke it out. I assume by the end of March, we'll have some more bullshit.
Yeah.
Just play some darts and throw it at the dartboard to see who's which companies are left that didn't lay anybody off.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we'll end it there. So yeah, thank you to Brandon and Dan for joining this week.
Always.
We'll be back next week with a new slate of news and hopefully some more positive stuff.
Hopefully.
And if you are enjoying it, feel free to let friends and family know to check out the podcast and hear more depressing stories. If you want to share that shared trauma of getting laid off that everybody has.
Yeah.
Except for the Nepo kids.
Yeah, screw those guys.
Yeah, so yeah. But thank you all for tuning in. I hope you have a good week ahead. We'll see you all next time. Have a good one.